Imagine flipping through channels this holiday season, and instead of simply watching whatever show or movie you landed on, you got to learn about the time period from which each program came. That's what my guests and I do here on the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, talking history through pop culture. Today's episode deals with three titles that find themselves on screens this time of year: 1965's A Charlie Brown Christmas, 1988's Die Hard, and Hook from 1991. Each of these pop culture artifacts are reflections of the state of the world at the time of which they were created. First up is my talk with Noella, whom I met at the National Council for the Social Studies annual conference held in Nashville earlier this month. As both an educator and an author-illustrator, Noella was drawn to the image of a Charlie Brown Christmas at my exhibit table. I love talking with makers on this show because they have special insights about what motivates them to create what they do, when they do, and how they do it. Take a listen.
Well, I'm so glad that Noella is here and that these internet connections actually work out. I know not everybody that I reached out to when you signed up for my giveaway, which let me give that to you now before I
forget. Ooh, fabulous.
So you get a nice sparkly sticker.
And I love a sticker.
Perfect thing to have for an audio medium is to talk about stickers that are sparkly. Nobody can see them at all. But well, first of all, you are from California. So as of right now, you are from the farthest away on my podcast as far as the in-person kind of thing. So have you been to this conference before?
I have not. I am a first-time attendee. I've wanted to come for many years, but have never had the opportunity. But I'm now with a school that is supportive of professional development, and awesome. So they were willing to support me.
That's really great. And what is it? Is it a public school that you work at, or?
Right now, this is an independent school, so it's nonprofit, but it is private.
Great. And so, therefore, you feel that the reason I made sure to talk to you is because you have a creative outlet that. It seems to go really well in hand with what you do at your school, right? That
yes.
They kind of play, you know, off each other in a certain way. Could you describe what your endeavors are outside of the classroom?
Absolutely. Because I've loved history for so long, and I was initially an artist, it was a nice way for me to be able to combine my two passions. My undergraduate degree is actually animation.
Oh.
But the industry went kaput right when I was graduating from college, so I went to my second love, which was history. And when I'm thinking about what I want to do with my life, I was able to find the combination of history and art through writing graphic novels of historical fiction.
So that's exactly the reason I said I need to. And I'm going to use this question. We're going to start with talking about your work.
Okay.
And then we're going to move it on to some pop culture. I mean, it won't be long before yours is pop culture, too.
I hope
Everybody's
so.
Everybody's going to know it. But when it comes to, because how long would you say it takes to, from conception or, when you think of the idea to completion, roughly, to do one of your stories?
Well, working with historical fiction and graphic novels are incredibly time consuming because as an author and an illustrator, the writing is one huge piece, but the art is another whole beast on its own. So the writing goes through a lot of different steps because it's not written like a traditional fiction novel. It's got to read like a comic book. It's got to read like...
So it's almost like a screenplay?
So it's actually written exactly like a screenplay. So we use a screenplay format. And so that can be, right now it's been 2 years that I've been working on this one. And it from the research to the character development, it all comes together, but it takes a long time to kind of put the perfect pieces in place.
So that always comes to mind with any of these things, whether it's a movie. I think music is probably the one that's the quickest turnaround time. Somebody's like, I have an idea, I'm gonna write it down. They can do it in a day sometimes.
Right.
But movies, TV shows, art, books, these are time consuming things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you choose your topic or the material to base your story on, what do you think brings you to those decisions? What stories from history do you tend to get drawn to?
Well, my current work is called Fanny's Fight, and it's actually about women who hid their identity as men to fight in the Civil War. And so because that was my focus in college for my history side, I found it really interesting and not really something that was well known to the public. So that really got me thinking about my own identity and how I've felt like I've wanted to be in certain places that I wasn't welcome based on my gender, and really thought of that as an amazing way to let girls who like to do boy things find their own voice in that. And so it's been bopping around in my head for probably about 20 years before I actually got to the point where I was starting to write and develop characters.
That demonstrates that it's actually like a meaningful endeavor. It's not just like, hey, that's popular, I'm going to do this.
Right. You know, it's like, I'm going to take this and stick it in a book.
Right. And you take a lot of time to decide, you know. And I think that that's even comic strips have that component to them, you know, of a character, you know, and it's like now this character behaves this way because of, you know, it's like Little Women. That is a story that's been told and retold over and over again from obviously the original text all the way up to, I just saw a musical version a few weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know there was a musical version.
Yeah, I didn't
version.
Either. I didn't know it was a musical until moments before it started. We thought we were seeing the play, and they're like, oh. I inquired with my wife, and believe me, we're going somewhere with this. I'm not just on a weird tangent, but my wife and I was like, so how come Little Women has been made so many times, and Gone with the Wind has only been made once?
Right.
And she's like, well, because that's a... Little Women has like a story and a message that you want to keep going. And she said it well. She's like, there was people even in the 30s that said that we shouldn't even be making Gone with the Wind once, you know, let alone over and over again. So it's like that same thing where it's like you're pulling from a character that a real person that lived in the 1860s.
Yes.
And their experience then was specific to their world. But when you boil it down, it's still something that runs through all time.
Exactly. That through line is really crucial.
Okay.
Especially in history, because kids can easily be turned off of learning topics that they don't feel connected to because it happened a long time ago, and that's not what things are like now. So finding that connection point, starting with a personal experience and then knowing that my personal experience isn't isolated, that it's going to be something that other kids have experienced in their own lives, is really important to be able to get that message across, just like Little Women gets that message across.
And I'm glad, you know, because in the modern age, you could do a lot of things with these stories. You could podcast it. You could make an animated feature on television. You could... But what is it about books? And even graphic novels, because they're still books. I know there's debate about that among librarians, but I think most modern librarians are like, no, they're
absolutely
books.
Absolutely.
What is sort of sacred about a book that you like, I want to write a book. I don't want to make a movie out of this. I don't, you know, a book comes first.
Well, I think that with a book, it's able to reach such a wider audience due to the availability between libraries and classrooms. There's so much value in being able to hold a concrete example of something. With graphic novels particularly, it's going to reach readers who aren't always going to want to read a full novel, who get intimidated by that. It's going to appeal to visual learners. And I find what really makes a graphic novel special is all of the pieces that can go into the art that don't need to be addressed in the words. So you can look and really look into the visual and see so many details that would be passed over in a movie, right? Because the pace is just going, going, going. But with a book, the reader sets the pace. So if they want to spend more time with this visual or with these words, they can. they'll go back and look at it again and again and again. And I see that with my own children because they love graphic novels as much as I do. And so seeing their experience with them is very different than seeing it in a movie or a TV show.
And it makes it much more personal.
Absolutely.
They can, the voice in their head as they read is going to be different from the next person.
Exactly.
And that's, I know that they tend to, books seem to be the source for movies all the time. It's just going to happen. It's always been happening. I remember when Harry Potter was really big, and I'm like, yeah, they're going to make a movie out of this, guaranteed. And I was kind of bummed out about that, because I'm like, the reason why it's even on the news that kids are reading again is because it was all text-based, and like, we're going back to books again. But once the movies come out, there goes any imagination. Harry has to talk like this. Hermione looks like this. Mm-hmm. You know, you have no choice. I wanted to bring this back around to what we're talking with, though, because one of the other things I love about books, especially in libraries, not bookstores so much, but libraries, is the experience of a child feeling like they are the only ones that discovered this thing, that they were going through all the spines. You know, it's not that impressive to find the one the librarian put out for you.
Right.
Like, everyone should read this. But you're going through all the spines, like, and it's kind of, and then, wow. And feeling like it's just talking directly to you. And especially if you're a kid that has something going on in common with the characters of the books, it's like it's your own.
Yes. Like the author was speaking to you. Like,
exactly.
You have this relationship that's, that is one-sided because the author doesn't know you, but feels a connection that's deeper than
just a movie.
Than just
has
a movie
a title
that
screen,
exactly
credits. You're done. You know.
Like, yes, absolutely.
You can't stay in the theater. You know, and like the usher's gonna kick you out.
Exactly.
Like, oh, this movie meant a lot to me. I want to go back. You know, a book you can go back to the pages that you care about, and there are some books, graphic novels that we do that with, and one that stood out to me, and I think about it not all the time, it'd be kind of weird, but I remember when I was a kid coming across in the children's section these like long books of Peanuts.
Yes,
from,
absolutely.
Like, the 50s.
Yes.
When they were drawn really well.
Yeah.
Because admittedly, by the time you get to like the 70s, like
yeah, it's getting quick. It's quick.
And you know, definitely by the 80s, it's like Charlie Brown's all wobbly and stuff. But like when they were sharp looking,
oh, very much.
And you know, they'd obviously been on the shelf for a long time, and there weren't like a ton of copies of them. So when I took them out and brought them home, I was probably the only one within a 50-mile radius, maybe even greater than that, because who's reading Peanuts book collections from the 50s?
Me.
Right. So on other sides of the country.
Yep, on other sides of the country.
That's pop culture. That's its power right there. You said that artwork really inspired you. But I feel like with Peanuts, is something just a little bit beyond just the artwork.
Absolutely. I think that there is that, again, talking about how you're able to connect with characters, especially when you're a kid, having those wanting to fit in feelings and really wanting to have friends like Charlie Brown and just kind of not being able to find your way. It's not a lack of trying. It's not a lack of desire. It's just you keep going even through that, you know, that pushback. And I think about during Charlie Brown Christmas when he's the director and everyone goes boo. And it's not subtle, but he still continues. He still is going to make the show happen. He's going to do it his way. And I think that's powerful to be able to see that.
That is, and, you know, so the question I pulled, and I'll bring up the material it's made from, for something like the Charlie Brown, you know, it's Charlie Brown's Christmas, or, you know, that you'd think that the basic material, Christmas, that's the material it's based on. Well, yeah. But it's all those other things, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they could have told a Christmas story, and they did, with a lot of other characters. I mean, for a while there, that was, like, the thing you did, was if you had any kind of character, once the holiday shows up, boom.
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, Charlie Brown's probably the most famous of those, but it's something about those characters combined with Christmas that makes the story what it is.
Right.
Where you're able to see a kid that his friends, like, hate him. They're not even friends. Like, they really take any chance they
can get. Classmates.
this is the second time today I've talked about Poor Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Earlier we were talking about on Halloween how apparently the neighborhood adults
they gave
collect
rocks.
Just for this kid. Like, okay, when that kid shows up, we hate him so much that we're going to give him a rock and break his teeth. I mean, at least he identifies as a rock
yes.
as soon as he gets it instead of
But after every doorbell, I got a candy bar, I got it this, I got it that, I got a rock.
I know. It's like, stop trick-or-treating,
yeah.
but he doesn't give up.
No.
He's like, things are going to turn around.
Yep.
He's a very hopeful kid. The Thanksgiving special came out, and they, as they're advertising in the piece that I brought along, A Charlie Brown Christmas is coming to television again. Just think, we've become a classic. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That was broadcast a couple years after. Actually, several years after. This one probably from... Yeah, this looks like 1980, maybe. That you know, they kept bringing it back around. But to make sure that we see it, it's McDonald's and
Absolutely.
Coke.
Absolutely.
Coca-Cola Classic.
By.
But the subsequent specials, the Halloween one, it's the Great Pumpkin, the Thanksgiving one... Those are all based on the success of the Christmas one.
Absolutely.
And they have similar messages, but do any of them come close to the way the Christmas special went
for you? I think really because it was that initial kind of build, the animators, the writers... didn't have anything else to base it on. So they were just looking at the characters, looking at their personalities, looking at what they wanted to say without comparing to, you know, the success of something before that as far as the animation. And I think that makes it a really unique story. I think that it's interesting that they do take biblical content and put it on, you know, TV,
yeah.
whereas they don't reach to that for Halloween or Thanksgiving, right? It's the Great Pumpkin, not real. And they kind of talk the pilgrims a little bit. But
yeah.
with it's a very interesting take to...
It shows you the progression of American culture in
yes.
a very short amount of time.
Yes,
you know,
very much.
I had a conversation with my dad a couple months ago about this because, you know, he grew up in the... Like, he was born in the 40s, grew up, you know, young man in the 60s. And he said, back then, it wasn't do you go to church, it was which church you go to.
Exactly.
So you could put something like that on TV, and nobody's
going
to be like, oh, this is fine. This
yeah.
is exactly what should be on TV, is a reminder of the message of Christmas. Whereas you get to just 10 years later, and it's like, yeah, don't mention
we're
going
to need to yeah,
and,
tap that down.
Yeah, and just you know focus on you know some of the other components of it. And so it's a real good you know kind of tracker of where we are. So like... maybe I should just reinvent my entire thing. Just like Charlie Brown in history.
Yes.
Like, you know, and honestly, I've seen people do that with Superman. I've
mm-hmm.
seen them do it with other comic book characters.
For sure.
And just, you know, kind of the iterations of them as they go along. And yeah, they're, to a certain extent, Charlie Brown's the same way. Or just Christmas specials in general.
Absolutely.
They've transformed probably about 20, 30 years ago to holiday special.
Yes.
You know, to be more inclusive. You know,
Absolutely.
To make sure they recognize it's not just Christmas that's celebrated that time of the year and that there's value beyond just the gift-giving component of it. Beyond the Charlie Brown ones, do you feel any kind of, like, sacredness towards or appreciation for any of the other animated...
Oh,
Christmas specials and
absolutely.
Things.
Growing up, I planned my life around those 2 weeks of screening. So I had my TV guide out, and I'm circling it, making my list.
Checking it twice.
I loved the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer stop motion.
Mm-hmm.
That blew my mind as a kid because I understood the fact that everything was built and that kind of tactile really spoke to me. But again, they're all so mean. Like everybody
yeah.
in like the 60s and 70s were super mean. Like those poor toys that
yeah.
got booted to an island.
The misfit toys. I was just thinking about this recently, actually talking about it with somebody, because we did a full-length episode about The Nightmare Before Christmas,
mm.
which just turned 30, and how those stop animation that was meant to be kind of like a satirical take on those, or
right.
like a 90s spin
yes.
on, you know, much darker,
the darker side of it,
of those kinds of things. But they're pretty dark as it is.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, those kind of blend all together into me, you know, for me, because it's like there was just so many of them.
Yes.
It seemed that at any point, I think we probably grew up in a similar time mm-hmm. period, late 80s,
yep.
you know, 90s,
yep.
where during the holiday season, at any point you can just turn on and be like, it's one of them.
I don't know. One of them.
I'm not sure which one this is. But even the characters in those have a very Peanuts-esque appearance to them.
Yes.
Very rounded faces, mm-hmm. you know, almost like the Campbell Soup Baby.
Exactly.
You know, look to them. Do you think that, you know, and not to mention, one thing we should have mentioned with Charlie Brown is the jazz music, Vincent Guerrero.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
That guy. That drives the story.
Right.
And I could listen to just the soundtrack all day. Like, I love the, it's Christmas time, especially minus the vocals.
Right.
And the ice skating.
Absolutely.
You know, just, you can
it's
hear
iconic. The snow,
it's
absolutely
iconic. You can hear
the snow iconic.
Falling to
yes.
that music. And so it's like, that's the material too.
Mm-hmm.
Those, and you know, those stop motion ones, some of them had some songs.
Yeah.
Like Burl Ives
yes.
would be in it, or it wasn't, Bing Crosby did one of them, right?
He did. I think that was Santa Claus is Coming to
yeah,
Town.
Yeah.
He was the mailman.
Yeah. That was, his toy looked kind of freakish.
Yeah.
Like super.
Very, very, trying, it kind of gets to that uncanny valley place
yeah,
where they're like trying to make it look
Lady
just
Elaine
like him.
Lady Elaine from,
yes.
you know, Mr. Rogers'
oh,
Neighborhood
yes.
kind of thing. So it's almost like we're all pulling from this one giant pot, this
yes.
vat of like early 20th century depictions of children that they're like scooping heavy Campbell's soup scoops from. And applying it to the rest of the 20th century. And so by the time we get to the end of it, we're like, whoa, there's a lot of this going around. Like
yes.
we have baby after baby and, you know, baby child, rounded face, you know, doing all these things. And very few adults around in a lot of these stories. It's, you know, it's like this A number one in children's literature or juvenile fiction. Get rid of the parents. Some
way. Get them
way.
Out of the way. Yep.
Get, you know, the kids are the ones doing all this stuff. So, as you watch these this year, or whenever you want, streaming, you can watch Christmas anytime, you can be thinking the material's not just Christmas.
Right.
So much more to it.
So much more.
And as an artist yourself, as a writer yourself, you especially can attest to that. Do you? And we'll wrap things up by asking, if you don't mind a personal question, your
sure.
workspace, is it crazy cluttered with all sorts of like scraps of paper and books and... things all over the floor and
yes.
every surface covered?
Yes. There's nothing that's pretty. There's nothing that is nice and neat and straight. It is doodles on scraps of paper, and it's napkin notes. And if it pops in my head, I got to get it out before
yep.
I forget. And so trying to, anytime I've tried to organize it, I end up losing it because I know the mess, but don't know the cleaned up version. So it's definitely because it's exciting.
Yeah.
I'm not going to just, you know, sit down and then write. It's where the ideas come and putting them all together, and sometimes things get taken out and stuck in, and so it is. It's no one would call me clean and organized.
So it's not like one of those stock photo, like if I typed in like writer's office and you see somebody behind a desk
no.
with a single laptop.
No.
Like, you know,
no.
Nothing like that at all.
It's surrounded by the books that influenced me. It's surrounded by the pictures. It's surrounded by the what's inspiring, because that's what's going to really push and drive what my goals are.
That must be so much fun to, I know what your story is based on history, but to be the creator of, it's going to sound huge, but creator of worlds. I mean, you are creating.
Yeah.
And with that knowledge of somebody else taking part in it, that must be exhilarating.
You know, it really is. I think it's because it's my way of connecting to something that seems so incredible and beyond what I think I could do. So it's allowing me to enter into that world that I couldn't possibly be in any other way.
It's And I remember the very first time I made a podcast, I felt weird when I hit like publish. So I'm like, man, anybody who wants to listen to this can now.
Yeah.
And I have no control over
right. it. Right. It's you've birthed the baby. Right. It's out in
and
the
now
world.
It's wandering around there. And then I was like kind of bummed when like nobody was listening. I've got more listeners now. One's right in front of me. But I've had a great, I'm glad that we got this to work. That was awesome.
I am too. It was
did
a wonderful
did you realize
experience.
When I did, like the same moment, like, oh yeah, there's the person yes. I wanted to talk to.
Yes.
Well, because it's just like a row of tables. Right. Like we all kind of blend into each other yes, at the same time. Like civics, civics, study civics. Pop culture. Oh, okay. Yeah. So thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I hope you have enjoyed the rest of your conference.
Absolutely.
You can learn more about Noella and her work at noellabickel.com. That's NoellaBickel.com. And while you're online, check out my page at everythinghistory.com. There you can learn more about the podcast, listen to episodes, book podcast karaoke events, and reach out about consulting and coaching opportunities. That's everything-history.com. Although the film came out 35 years ago, the question as to whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie seems to have risen out of nowhere in just the last couple of holiday seasons. I spoke with fellow New Hampshire social studies teacher Adam at the New Hampshire Council for the Social Studies conference earlier this fall, and I feel like he settles the debate once and for all.
Council for the Social Studies annual conference. Have you come to this conference before?
It's my second year coming.
In a row?
Second year consecutively, correct.
Nice. And what do you usually pull from the conference that you like the most?
I usually look for a little bit of content to integrate in my classroom. I teach 19th century U.S. history to 7th graders. So
it can be a struggle sometimes.
Yeah,
if only we had stories like Die Hard from that time period.
If only we had it.
And that's going to be our subject for today. So your eyes immediately came across the VHS, and that's exactly why I brought it, because I find a lot of my stuff, including this, in the bin at a thrift store, and I was actually surprised that nobody plucked it up, because VHSs are collectible again.
A dollar or whatever, $3 for that?
Probably even less, because I got it at Goodwill by the pound, where they weighed it out, and I think media at Goodwill by the pound is like 10 cents a pound, so you can get like books and records and all this kind of stuff. Most of what's on my table comes from there.
Deal of the century.
It's awesome, and yippee-ki-yay, right?
Absolutely.
I won't say the rest of that line, but I guess I can always edit things. So the way it works is I have one question from my primary source analysis form that I use in my classroom, and it's kind of like a game show today. So the question that we're dealing with right now for Die Hard is, what material is this made from? And we're going to use the answer to that to figure out something about the late 1980s when this movie was made and became popular. So the debate that's been going on for, it seems to have just come up in the last couple of years.
Yes, the pop culture debate.
I've even had a student like ask me this seriously last year. They actually weren't like joking around. They're like, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Answer now. And I'm like, what's your stance on it?
Yes. Takes place during Christmas. It's got Christmas themes of it. It's got a redemption theme in it for John Wayne. Or, excuse me.
John McClane.
John McClane. Yeah. Absolutely. The music in it. It's got the Christmas themes all over. Is it your happy, normal Christmas movie? Absolutely not. Ho, ho, ho. Mm-hmm. Now I have a machine gun. Ooh. Not super Christmassy. However, maybe it is. It's definitely a Christmas movie, I think.
So what does it take to make a Christmas movie? Is it just enough to have, you know, in other words, like, would the story, would the material of this movie be correct to any other time of the year?
I mean, parts of it definitely are correct. You know, it's an action movie from the 80s. So
yeah.
There's the explosions, there's the one-liners, there's all that stuff that is applicable to any season of the year. However, the Die Hard movie, especially the bad guy Hans Gruber, I think represents a lot of Christmas and kind of the duality of it, or what's wrong with Christmas.
Like a Grinch type character,
yeah,
almost.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. He's going to steal Christmas.
He has that famous line of, it's Christmas, it's the season of miracles.
Right. And it's you know, It takes place in a high-rise building in Los Angeles, in the 80s, so you have like that, you know, I always feel like, I mean, LA is not usually the setting for Christmas stories. Usually it's like the Midwest or New York. New York tends to have the...
Lethal Weapon 1 is kind of a Christmas movie, and that takes place in L.A. and during Christmas.
Yeah, so it's like almost
it's the
like
same kind of era.
L.A. raising its hand, be like, you know, we have Christmas spirit here, too. We might not get the snow. We might not get all the symbols that you usually associate with Christmas, but we're still enjoy the season. And it's a Christmas party happening at the office that his wife is at. That it's
Nakatomi Plaza. It's interesting, too, at the time the American-Japanese relations going on and how that's tied into the movie as well.
This is all... So when I say material, a lot of people think of... Because, you know, these questions are used to analyze any primary source.
Correct.
And as a teacher, you know this. Most of the time, we think of primary sources as things like newspapers, which I have a few of.
Right, journal entries, just typical stuff in
the classroom.
Yeah, those
kind of boring, you know, old... They have to be old-looking to be a primary source, but... And those ones, it's easy. It's like paper and ink is the material it's made from. But then there's the intangible things like the time of the year or the overall feel of the 1980s, that the setting of this one. Now, my favorite Die Hard movie is actually the third one, Die Hard with a Vengeance, because...
Three's really good. That's one of Jeremy Irons, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's really good.
And he's Hans Gruber's brother.
Yeah, I thought it was better than two.
Samuel Jackson is in it, and he's always great. And I love stories where it's all takes place in one day, which this one also has. But I love, like, where they in the third one, they go from one end of New York to the other. They
go all the way to Canada. They're going through the tunnels and driving the dump trucks.
And like, how does somebody have the energy to do all this? Well, he is John McClane, after all. I love that one the most. And that one came out in the late 90s, so it's more reflective of...
Yeah, it's like 96 or 97.
97,
something like that.
Around there. And it kind of reflects... Like, and it takes place in New York, so it's like that New York Renaissance that was going on, where the streets became safer, and like the Giuliani era, and it's just kind of like, don't, you know, while the streets might be a little bit safer than they were back in the 80s, you can still have some pretty terrible things happening right below our nose, right? It seems to be the message of that one. The material for this one, though, you were already hinting at it. What is the conflict going on? What is Hans Gruber after?
Well, Hans Gruber's after money. He's after, negotiable bearer bonds that are stashed there in the building. And that's the overall conflict between the main bad guy, Hans Gruber, who's a mercenary / East German terrorist.
Yeah.
Guy. I like his whole made-up group, the Volksfrei movement that he talks about. And I can nerd out on this all day. But the real redemption arc is with John McClane and his wife, Holly. And that's what the real story is about. It's a love story, too. And incorporates that. And that's the whole point, is he's traveling out there for the holidays to try to redeem himself with his wife. Ends up kind of blowing it, but then kind of saving the day. And then Hans Gruber tries to get in his way as the Grinch, who is attempting to literally steal Christmas.
And her name is Holly, so add that to another.
There you go, Christmas
as to why this is even more Christmassy. So it's like the debate of modern day pop culture of deciding this is a Christmas movie or not really is no debate at all, is what you're saying.
It's 100% a Christmas movie. It's, like, at least for people from our generation. I'm not sure how old you are. We're similar in age, early 40s. Yep. I had this same VHS growing up. That's what attracted me to it when I walked by. I have literally watched that on VHS probably 150 times as a kid growing up.
Well, it's a year before Home Alone.
Yeah.
Which that's is absolutely a Christmas movie, but it has some of the same themes.
Yep.
You know,
Joe Pesci is just trying to steal Christmas.
Class struggle. You know, John McClane's a working class cop, and he's going against these guys who are, you know, they're terrorists. They're, you know, but they're like the modern chic.
They dress nicely, and the latest,
and they're bankrolled by, you know, some
European firearms at the time.
Right,
that Steyr AUG that Carl has.
It kind of, I think, for a lot of us watching that, and also Commando, which
Commando
came out a couple years before.
Commando was good. Predator came around. Conan the Barbarian. I can go on. Don't get me going.
These kind of movies, but in Commando, it's like they make up a whole South American, you know, Central American country, and audiences are just kind of like, yep, like both that and Die Hard, like, yep, makes sense. Like that would happen.
Back in my home country, Barbados.
Yeah. I actually did a whole episode about Commando a couple years ago.
Commando's pretty good. Ray Don Chong. Yep. She's the actress in that. And what's her name? Alyssa Milano when she's the kid.
Yep, she's a little
kid. Then Bennett, the bad guy, is also, I can't remember the actor's name off the top of my head, it's Mike something, but he's in the Road Warrior. He's the
big guy.
My brother met him at one of the Comic Cons, and the guy was the opposite of nice. I don't want to speak too disparaging, but he's some, you know, really great movie roles, but he was kind of a jerk in real life.
Was he dressed as he was in Road Warrior? Because that would make me not very happy either.
If I had to stand around chaps.
The mask on and be like, you know, just walk away. just walk away.
What a puny plan.
Yeah. It's amazing how these things go on wonderful tangents. I love this.
And Die Hard in particular, I don't know. I try to make my wife watch it every year because it's always on demand somewhere on Christmas. She doesn't get it. She's a little bit younger than me.
Another thing is, like you mentioned, this is an action movie from the 80s. That's another part of the material of it. By 1989, we just listed off a few of them. This became a whole part of movies was the action film, the shoot 'em up, you know, the good guy, you know, kind of the everyman good guy that saves the day. And
it's a rebirth of the cowboy kind of characters,
right.
And maybe that's an anti-hero aspect that comes out in all the earlier, like, Eastwood movies, or, mm-hmm. I mean, you can go back even further with that.
And so it's like, McClane is that kind of, like, if you were to put him as, like, Christmas icons, like, which, you know, so if Hans Gruber is the Grinch, what's John McClane? Is he...
I mean, who saves Christmas in The Grinch, if we're going to make that comparison? Is he Cindy Lou Who?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Like,
oh, no.
Stops him. And,
yeah.
You know,
no.
Carrying on.
I'm not really sure if he has a necessary comparison in traditional Christmas stories that I can think of off the top of my head. However, he does play a person who is trying to, like I said, it's a redemption arc story for him, and how you can conquer evil, I suppose, as Hans Gruber, be represented by sacrificing yourself. Mm-hmm. And he's willing to sacrifice himself and put himself in harm's way, in danger, in order to try to overcome the evil Grinch of Hans Gruber.
If we pile it in with all the other Christmas movies of that era, I already mentioned
Home Alone.
The other John Hughes movie that came out, I think, in 89 also is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, which is also a redemption story.
It is,
you know, throughout that movie, he redeems himself a couple times, in fact, because he wants so badly, just like in Vacation, to give his family the perfect Christmas.
Lights in that are always still, like...
I love that scene.
Anytime I'm putting Christmas lights on, that's what you're always thinking of, falling off a ladder, doing the shenanigans.
Even though he doesn't do it, his cousin does take extreme measures involving firearms, Cousin Eddie.
It's Randy Quaid, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
He goes and gets the...
Rest in peace, Randy Quaid.
The boss, the big corporate guy that is uncaring and, you know, heart of... You know, a black heart guy that's kind of grinchy in a way because he stole Christmas from them with the Christmas bonus. And yet it's, I wouldn't put Clark Griswold as working class, but he's blue collar or white collar.
Yeah, he's trying to be. He's a good family man, like John McClane is trying
middle class guy, you know, and he does what he has to do to save the day. So I think if we line all these movies up from the same time period, even if this one has the cowboy shoot 'em up component to it, it's still... meets those boxes being checked as 100% Christmas movie.
Is it a family Christmas movie?
No.
Probably not. I've got a 6-year-old daughter. Yeah, I'd say, you know, yes.
I mean, we haven't talked about the VHS component. We don't have the time for that.
I can talk. I mean, I can nerd out about the Japanese manufacturing of the Sony at the time, and it kind of goes back into that because it's a VHS tape, so it's that nice plastic, but... I mean, kids nowadays don't remember.
No, because there's a whole culture that this...
And you used to play them until they wore out, and they get all warpy, and you have to know how to adjust the tracking.
Right, you knew the parts that it was going to start wobbling if you watched enough.
Yeah.
If you recorded, you know, these ones that were pre-recorded were always much better quality.
Yeah.
If you recorded off of HBO, you had a weird buzzing sound.
Yeah, you always
in the
had a weird buzzing sound online. You couldn't quite adjust the tracking.
You know, I think they did that on purpose as a way to, you know, encourage you to buy the real one.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, that... is why we are.
Can I hold it while we're talking about it for a second? I'll be careful, I promise.
No. That's why we are the way we are with our movies, is because we watch them over and over and over
Literally over and over again.
But it was a much more personal relationship with the movie. Nowadays, it's all streaming, so we don't really have...
No, you're not digging through.
You can still watch it over and over again, but it's not the same as, like, physically taking it off the shelf, you know, taking it out of its box, putting it into the VCR... hoping that you rewound it before you,
right,
you know,
put it back, or you got
so you're not
gonna find
get
a
the
dollar.
Credits, you know, right? So it's been wonderful talking to you.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for stopping by.
Anytime.
And I hope you enjoy the rest. Bye.
Before you type your emails complaining that we were off by a year with Die Hard, I want to defend Adam and I, and the podcast karaoke process, in that we didn't use any other sources besides the VHS that was on hand to drive our discussion. The tape in its box came out in 1989, even though the film came out in July of 1988, tally point for it not being a Christmas movie, and so that's what we had to work with. The layout of this episode is kind of funny in that the artifacts and subjects are going forward in time, but the recording sessions are moving backwards. I spent some time this summer in Prescott Park in Portsmouth, New Hampshire for a few different functions, including an outdoor screening of 1991's Hook. This is my all-time favorite version of the Peter Pan story, and the more I watch it and learn new things about the movie, the more it is confirmed what a deliberate movie maker the director Steven Spielberg is. Hook could have taken place at any time of the year, but using Christmas as the backdrop connects this 1990s update of the Peter Pan story to the original play's debut 2 days after Christmas in 1904. Take a listen to Danny and I and our conversation about this film.
But I've never seen the original movie itself all the way through.
Do you think it might have something to do with like the mindset of like once you've seen all one Peter Pan movie, you've seen them all? Like, do you feel like it's not?
I think the vibe that I've gotten from the clips that I've seen is that it puts like a bit of a twist on it, but yeah. I think it seems that it does like follow the usual story. But I don't know why it's called Hook and not just Peter Pan.
Right.
So I assume it might focus more on Captain Hook himself.
It's funny because, yeah, you learn a little bit more about him from the movie, but I'm so glad you pointed that out because I think, and I remember when the movie came out, I was about 10 years old, so like I was aware enough, you know, of what, and I think it kind of, it goes with the way things were in media back then of like real cool sounding, you know, because like when you call it Hook,
yeah,
you know, you can use like the steel blade imagery, and
it's a literal hook for the audience to catch themselves
exactly,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's like, you know, like blade or
yeah,
you know, like
yeah, exactly,
fire, you know, it's like, or like you know, the
rain,
Chicago
yeah,
Bulls,
like
you know, just like simple and effective and stuff like that, and I think it kind of tried, and it's funny because they made. I think the next major motion picture version of the story or anything related to it was the early 2000s, and it was just called Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when this one was being advertised, it was like you saw, and Peter Pan's a kid in this one again, and you see him standing there with his sword, and it's like a silhouette of him with the pirate ship in front of him, and it said something like, the battle is on, or the battle begins. Ooh,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah, like more of like a battle or action-y
yeah,
thing. Yeah,
and when you watch it, it's like, no, this is the same Peter Pan story that Disney told. It's the same one that Mary Martin had. It's the same one. It's the same one that was, you know, was originally written as a play and then a book by the name is my wife's going to kill me because it's like her favorite story.
Like Peter Pan, like one of those like Disney stories where like the original story was like a lot, what was like a lot darker than the material that they put
yeah,
out.
Yeah, so there's the J.M. Barrie. That's the name of the guy who wrote it in England. Turn of the century, and you're right because in that and so that was something that the 2003 when you know 2000 yeah around 2003 movie tried to do was go back to the original text a bit more and try to. And right around that same time, they made a biopic about J.M. Barrie called Finding Neverland. And it's all about, you know, and Johnny Depp plays him. And it's like how he became, you know, how he came to write the story for. And it was basically like a gift to these kids that, you know, they had a widowed mom and he was like helping them out and stuff like that. And he that's where the story comes from. My wife could explain it much better than I. But you're right. The original story does have a bit more of darkness to it. The Disney one in the 50s really gussied it up quite a bit and made it, well, it was a cartoon, but it was super cartoonish.
Oh, yeah.
So Hook 1991, I think, kind of pulls from all of those because Dustin Hoffman's Hook is pretty fearsome, but he also has his cartoony moments, right? He looks a lot like the way that Disney presents Captain Hook with the big red coat and the
the big feather in his
cap. Like and even Smee, you know, his first mate, very much looks like the Disney version of Smee and acts like that version of Smee. But it's like it is a bit I think it's pretty well balanced. It's about Hook. And in this version, not to give it away, but we meet a middle-aged Peter Banning. He doesn't realize that he's Peter Pan.
Oh, okay.
And even when Wendy, who's like an old lady, by that point, you know, kind of hints at it and tells him, "You are Peter Pan."
He's interesting.
He's like, "No, I'm not Peter Pan."
So does this movie like take place kind of like chronologically, like before or after, like the like the original like Peter Pan story events? Or
so
is it
the way they explain it is that when you go to Neverland, you don't age.
Yeah.
Right. So he, and you'll see in the movie tonight, there's like a flashback sequence. He when he does come to realize that he is Peter Pan, he recounts his story, and it's like late 19th century, he was a little baby, and then he got whisked off to Neverland, where he, and the only reason he grew up is because periodically he'd come back to Earth, and so when you come back to Earth, you grow a little bit more.
Oh, okay.
But he still maintained himself to be a little kid. And then, long story short, it takes place in the 90s. It takes place in the year that the movie came out. And by that point, he's like a lawyer, like a corporate attorney, and he's not at all the whimsical, you know, kid who never wants to grow up. He's a middle-aged guy with a
There were a lot of those movies around then where it was like corporate guy like goes to like magical land. I think like Jungle to Jungle followed that beat a little bit. And
even Jumanji, which Robin Williams is in that one too. Very similar look to him when he first arrived. It's almost a reverse. He like comes out of Jumanji looking like Wild Man. And
I'm sure there's a conspiracy theory out there like linking the two movies.
Exactly.
Somehow.
Like once he goes into one, you know, he's in the other. And, you know, so you're right about that. And there was like, in the late 80s, there was like Father Like Son. That was another one where, and there was, I forget if that was the one with, there was one with Judge Reinhold, who like the and Fred Savage, where they switch bodies. And it's like father and son switch, and like, Jungle to Jungle is another great example. It's like they had this fantasy, like the fantasy of like what's it like to be a kid forever, or
like
when
you
forgot your childhood.
Yeah, and kind of like a same note. Well, kind of like reversed with Big with Tom Hanks, where like it's like a kid goes grown up. It's weird that like. They had that brief stint of like these guys like being like kids again and like finding that joy again, and then they like they grow from that.
And
that's
it has to do, I think, with the group of people that were coming returning older at that point in the 90s. That's like children, you know, the people, and he even says it in Hook. He's like, you know, he mentions about the 60s, and there's so many jokes like that in those movies. Like, well, I don't remember the 60s, you know, and you know, just to kind of like. Recognize that they're boomers, right? They're baby boomers, even though Peter Pan's not, because he was born in like 1910. But you know, what he represents is baby boomer. So they were wild flower children in the 60s and 70s, and now by the 90s they're all grown up, they have kids, they have responsibilities. You know, I think that was just kind of that feeling of the time. And simultaneously, there was, I think, it seemed like a cultural pushback of don't get rid of your youth. Stay young forever. Like Pee Wee Herman, you know, Paul Rubens just died recently.
And rest in peace.
Because I remember, like, the first time I saw his show, I was hooked. Not to use the name of this movie, but I was just, like, in love with it because, and he was kind of Peter Pan-esque, you know.
He acted
too young to be an adult, but he acted too old to be a kid. And it's like he was just, you know, living that life kind of thing and telling the kids it's okay to still have your toys
when you get older. It's like okay to like still play. That's something I learned like myself, like growing up through like high school and college with playing D&D a lot, the joy of like still having like space to like play with your friends and like still like being tapped into that that like a that like shared a creativity
yeah.
together. Yeah, it's been like such a joy, and I think it's done wonders for people's like mental health over the years. Like those kinds of games.
Right. I was actually yeah. I did a podcast with a gentleman who has a podcast about Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, awesome!
Called We Met in a Tavern, and he's right here in Portsmouth actually. And so he and we said the exact same thing, because when that game first came out in the '70s, and then it got really popular in the '80s, it was really, you know, kind of like there's an age limit to it. That it's like
yeah.
you're a teenager is like the oldest you should be playing Dungeons and Dragons. But then as time went on, people were like, well, why?
You know? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, why set that rule for yourself?
Yeah.
Like, why stop, you know? Like, if there's no good reason other than, like, oh, I'm too old for it. Like, that's a rule that you, like, set yourself.
Yeah.
And you can, like, take it away.
Because
anytime.
You want to keep up appearances.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. You want to be cool or grown
yeah.
up. Yeah.
And I feel like 1991, you start to see a turnaround in that.
Yeah.
Where, so in Hook, one of the lost boys came back to Earth, and now he works as like a, I don't know, he works in Wendy's house in modern London, and he's an old man, and he seems he's like, I lost my marbles, and he's like all, and Peter kind of looks at him dismissively, like when he first meets him or re-meets him, he's like, what's this guy's deal? But then by the end of the movie, when he comes back, and he's just so excited, and he like. This movie is, you'll see it, the way they treat cell phone technology is hilarious, because
that's great.
Cell phones were just like a new thing, and it was only really corporate America that was using them at that time. So there's all these like stupid like gunslinger jokes in, you know, they're like draw, you know, like fake rings.
Yeah.
And they like, you know, and he keeps getting pestered by it. It keeps pulling him away. This thing that actually sounds like Tinkerbell is pulling him away from his kids.
Okay.
And I just realized it. And so, you know, he gets frustrated. And by the end of the movie, he throws his cell phone out the window into a snowbank or something. And suddenly Toodles he's like, yeah, I want to be like you. I want to just, you know. And so it's like you said, some of those other titles treat that same idea of like, you're putting yourself in your own prison, man. Like wearing the suit.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, it was like the message was like, you can have a nice balance of both.
Yeah, I think there was also another like resurgence of that in like that theme in like the mid 2000s. Like there were all those like family movies. Like I think there was one like Nature's Vengeance or something with Brendan Fraser, where I think he follows the line where he's trying to like push back against nature and like being with his family. I didn't see the movie like myself, but I think I like got it from like the trailer that I saw, because a lot of those movies were pretty like cut and paste then.
Adam Sandler's Click kind of has that message.
Oh yeah,
too,
yeah, great example.
Of,
yeah,
you know, enjoy your family while they're,
yeah.
you know, while they want you around. They might not forever. They say almost the exact same thing in Hook. That's the message. There's also, well, actually, we totally missed it. Freaky Friday.
Oh my God! Yeah,
that's another.
Yeah, it's
you know,
a great example.
Mom and daughter switch roles, and then they remade that with Lindsay Lohan, late '90s, early 2000s, around there, where it's like the kids don't understand what it's like to be an adult, and why should they? They're kids. The adults have totally forgotten what it's like to be a kid, and so it's like them getting in touch with their childhood
and then finding a balance between it.
Saying okay,
an equilibrium.
It's funny because the kid who plays Peter's son in Hook is the same kid from What About Bob. It's like the only two movies he made, like he got out of acting. Pretty, but What About Bob even has elements of that too in similar time period. So like you have,
that's funny.
Bob, you know, it's 4th of July weekend, and his psychiatrist. Have you ever seen What About Bob?
I don't think I have.
It takes place here in New Hampshire. They filmed it in North Carolina.
Oh, really?
Carolina,
that's
but
cool.
It takes place in Lake Winnipesaukee. And he's played by Bill Murray. And he's somebody, he's in therapy with, he gets a new doctor, a psychiatrist, played by, why is these names escaping me right now? Maybe it's the wind. I can blame that. The guy from Jaws and American Graffiti and Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, that's okay.
And,
yeah.
And he
like he's very childlike in his way of thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very like and charming because of it. But he drives. He actually like follows a psychiatrist from New York City to New Hampshire, uh-huh. and keeps like showing up at his house, and like he becomes friends with his family, and he helps the boy, who in this in What About Bob, same kid is in that gets kidnapped by Captain Hook, to get over his fear of swimming, uh-huh. and teaches him to, and it's like. And gets along with him like a kid would. He's like, and so very like Peter Pan-esque,
yeah,
feel to it too. And it's the same thing where the dad, the psychiatrist, just so firm on being grown up and mature, and you know won't let his hair down at all. He just wants to, you know, make sure everything's just perfect. Uh-huh. And it's like that time period is all about. It doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just like just accepting life's little like in. Imperfect.
Yeah, and embracing them. Yeah, yeah. You know,
imperfections. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, it's like saying, okay, you know, it's nice because it isn't perfect.
Yeah,
and you know, we can live with that.
Yeah, like we can like wind down. I feel like Robin Williams character, like he's like the big lawyer. He like can wind down from the corporate stuff and just like enjoy life by just like taking a breath.
I think you're gonna really like the movie.
Oh yeah, I think I will. I absolutely love Robin Williams. I hadn't seen like Good Will Hunting until like I was in college, and until then I'd never really like gotten it or like really wanted to see it, but that movie blew me away, like just his like raw like tenderness with that character in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
Of like I just like telling Matt Damon like it's okay to cry.
It's one of his better movies.
Oh yeah.
I mean, not that he ever really made up. Well, I guess some movies aren't great, but I think that one stands out as one of his triumphs. Did he get an Oscar for that? Right.
I think he did. I know Damon and Affleck got the Oscar for like best screenplay for that one that year. I hope Robin got the award that year.
He's one of the few actors that's not from Boston who can nail the accent.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
like
true.
Damon and Affleck could do it, of course, because they're from there. But with you know, usually when it's like an outsider trying to do, they either do it way too thick,
yeah,
or it just sounds English or something. You know, it sounds hokey.
Yeah.
Robin Williams got it down. Like he's convincing that he's like a. I love that his character in that story because he's like, you know, he's friends with like the math genius guy.
Yeah.
But he's teaching at, you know, Bunker Hill Community College.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to a community college myself, and I definitely feel like they nailed that. They like kind of like summed up those first few years with that one guy saying, like, what's the meaning to life? Or love.
Yeah.
That's the usual vibe around there.
It's like like very similar to high school. Just kind of like, you know, similar vibe to it. Man, I didn't expect when we started talking about this we'd get to Bunker Hill Community College and that experience. Yeah. But
it's funny how the tangents go.
Yeah, I love it. So I guess the other component to this just to, you know, is like how is it made? I remember distinctly... I don't think I saw this in the theater. Like in those days, my family, we didn't go to the movies very often. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of money to spend on that kind of thing. Maybe I did. I don't know. But I remember it was in all the magazines talking about how elaborate the set was. Because this predates a lot of CGI.
It was still in that.
It was all practical effects.
Perfect like age in the 90s, like right before CGI started to take over, where like the sets looked amazing. Like I think Princess Bride had like that scene with right after they climb the rope, they have that amazing sword fight scene there, and I remember seeing that as a kid and being blown away by this like massive like kind of like playground. Like I just wanted to like go and jump around on it. It made me. Yeah, it was nuts.
And even like a sillier movie, another Robin Williams movie from about the previous decade, the Popeye movie.
Yeah.
They made like a whole fishing village, a real fishing village, just so they could film the movie. And so that movie bombed. Spielberg wanted this thing. I mean, he actually says he's unhappy with Hook. Looking back on it,
really?
He's not the biggest fan. But, I mean, I guess the artist is always his biggest critic, in a way.
Yeah. I think, like, David Lynch feels the same way about Dune when he made it. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a part of, like, growing up, even. It's just, like, you might like hate it, but I think that might just be like you changing from like when you made it. Like,
yeah.
You've just grown since then.
Because, I mean, things exploded for him not long after this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he made a series of, including Jurassic Park, which is like the world changing.
Oh my God.
Film.
I just watched that the other night. I'm just still blown away by that massive T-Rex animatronic.
It's so cool.
I don't know, like that movie, like, it was like so good. It set the bar like almost like too high for CGI. Because then, like, after that, like, stuff like never really like quite matched it, you know? It, like, there was like Lawnmower Man, like, those graphics never held up.
Well, thankfully that style didn't take off too much, because if we watch movies, it looked like, but, you know, like, lower budget studios were making movies like that for a while because they couldn't afford the good CGI. But this movie, Hook, came out just before that was an option even. So they had to build these elaborate sets. And I think it was, up to that point, the most expensive movie ever made. But it was cool because all the kid actors who played the Lost Boys got to, like, play around on the set.
Yeah.
It was like an actual, you know, interactive setting for them to be on. And, you know, I think... we'll leave with this. I think one of my funniest images in my head. So we haven't even talked about the main, you know, the title character, Captain Hook, but Dustin Hoffman, another brilliant actor. One of my favorite pieces of trivia I ever learned was, do you know that episode of Simpsons? I think it's from like season 2 or 3 when Lisa has a substitute teacher who's played by Dustin Hoffman. He doesn't use his name in the episode. Mm-hmm. So that was before the Simpsons were like the place to be. So
yeah.
Actors didn't want to necessarily
attach
themselves to it.
Yeah, like, they weren't sure if it was going to take off yet.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're like, I'll do it, but don't use my real name. So he did the voice, and they had to do a re-record of one of the scenes. So that end of the episode, when he's saying goodbye to Lisa and he writes her little notes, says like, I am Lisa Simpson. They had to visit the set of Hook to get him to do that.
Oh, really?
And so he's there in his full Captain Hook outfit talking like, you know, the substitute teacher.
That's
like,
great.
All like, all right, Lisa. You know, just like very quiet and, you know, nice and everything. And that's like the funniest image in my head, is to picture Dustin Hoffman sitting
like
there
that day,
like, dressed with his big mustache and, you know, looking all fearsome as the pirate. And then, you know, talking all sweetly to Lisa Simpson. So,
that's funny.
I hope you enjoy Hook tonight. I think you will.
Well, I can't wait to watch it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining.
These pop culture primary sources are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Christmas TV and movies. And two of them aren't even directly about the holiday. But they still inform us about the past nonetheless. So as you create your viewing lineup for the holiday season, know that you can use your movies and TV shows to read into different time periods, because everything is a primary source.